Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is Alan Fine. He is the president of Inside Out Development, and he has decided to share his pearls of wisdom with the world in his new book, You Already Know How to Be Great. Alan, welcome to the program. It is great to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Before we get into the book, I was hoping that we might spend a couple of minutes discovering who Alan Fine is. I understand you were born in Wales.
Born and raised, and was there until, my mid-20s.
North Wales or South Wales?
South Wales, Cardiff, the capital.
Oh, okay. In my youth, I used to trek off to a delightful little village in North Wales, Betsy Coed. It's a very pretty place.
Yes, or Betis y Coed to the Welsh.
Well, okay, I don't speak Welsh.
Yeah, that's two of us.
All right. What brought you to the United States?
Well, I'd actually been coming here for a number of years because it was the first country I'd ever wanted to visit, and it happened to be the first country I ever visited after leaving England and Wales. But we opened an office in the U.S. Inside Out was doing so much business here. We opened an office, took on a partner who lived out here in Utah, and so that's where the office went. And then after a couple of years, I was spending so much time in the U.S., I decided it would be smarter to live here and go back to Europe when I needed to. So I moved out, emigrated.
You were part of a brain drain.
Yeah, nobody's ever described it like that before, but I like it, yes.
Yeah. I did something similar. Yeah, I got to admit that I had a taste of North American life, and I just went, oh, it's time to climb on that 747.
But you did, didn't you?
Oh, I certainly did. Let's talk a little bit about some of your early experiences. I understand you were a tennis coach.
For about 15 years, yes. It's what I did when I managed to get thrown out of college. I was doing it beforehand, and I was thrown out of college for doing too much of it. And I did that, and it's actually the thing that led me on this journey to what I'm doing now. So tennis coaching actually was the first and probably the only thing I got formally qualified in.
Actually, in your book, you have this delightful story, actually two delightful stories. One concerns the very first tournament that you took part in, and you knew virtually nothing about tennis. Do you want to tell us that story?
It was actually worse than that, because as a child, I was severely asthmatic, and I wasn't able to do any physical activity until I was about 11 years old. So this was not only the first tennis tournament I entered, it was the first real physical activity I'd ever tried to do. And I got to the final against what I remember as being the school hormone freak, because this is a 13-year-old who had facial hair and was 6 foot tall and was captain of our school rugby team. And I was leading. I was 6'4", 4-love in the lead. And this is, I'd been on a tennis court about three times in my life prior to playing in this tournament. So I'm 6'4", 4-love in the lead. And, you know, I can even remember to this day where I stood on the court when it's like this voice went off in my head and said, "You've already won 10 games and you've only got to win two more and you'll be the school champion." And of course I froze. Never won another game, but I took up tennis with a vengeance after that, because that was the first time in my life that anybody had paid any attention to me.
So you took up coaching, and there's another delightful little vignette, the 10X student. Would you like to share that one?
Sure. What had happened was I'd been wrestling with some issues in coaching people, two in particular. One was some people found it easier to learn than others, and I couldn't figure out how to help those that struggled. And I had a couple of students who were very, very good athletes, but never got past semifinals in tennis tournaments. In other words, when they were under pressure, they didn't seem to be able to do what they did in practice. So it set me on a journey to find ways to help them. And that's what led me into sports psychology. And as I was on that journey, I guess it's a journey I'm still on, actually, I ran a lot of experiments with the things that I was learning. And one of them was with this 11-year-old girl. She'd had six lessons in the what I would call a traditional approach. And I'd given her the basics on how to hold the racket and where to place the feet. And she was having these lessons because her mother and I had agreed she wasn't very coordinated, and that if we could help her out, then she'd be able to do enough to get in, to hold her own in the group lessons, and that would be very good for her socially, because she was also quite shy. So we've had six lessons, and the most this young lady can do is get six balls over the net in a row if I put the ball on her racket. So it's kind of fairly solid evidence that this young lady wasn't very coordinated.
Right.
And then I decided, you know, what have I got to lose? I'll run an experiment with what I've been learning. And instead of asking her to think about, to remember all these things that we coaches think she should do to hit the ball properly, I said to her, "Would you just tell me when the ball bounces and tell me when it hits your racket by saying bounce when it bounces and hit when it hits your racket. Say it as close to those events as you can get it and say it out loud." So in the very first volley, this kid hits 53 balls in a row over the net. And after 15 balls, because you know we coaches can't stop messing with things, after 15 balls, I started moving it about the court instead of just putting it on her racket. So I'm making her run all over the court, and she's hitting 53 in a row. So the kid has got a huge smile on her face, and Mum has virtually fallen out of her seat. Her mother used to sit at the side of the court and watch this. And I was left standing there almost angry, because I was witnessing the biggest breakthrough I'd ever seen. And I didn't really understand why it was happening at that stage.
I think the word is simplicity. You know, we tend to overcomplicate our lives.
I think so. I think physical skills make it very apparent that there is a complexity. I mean, for this young girl to hit forehands over the net, we coaches can give you probably 20 different things that she needs to execute to be able to do that. But our minds are only going to process consciously one thing at a time. Unconsciously, they can process huge amounts of data. But consciously, they're only going to process one. So if we can help people select what that one thing to focus on is that causes all the other things to happen, that's when you begin to see breakthroughs. And I think that's, if we looked at the business world, I think that's a lot of what consultants do, is they look at the complexity of business and they find these models to help us think about the what is very complex in very simple terms. And that's what enables us to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you also mention that you were involved with coaching golf players. And I found that interesting because you make the statement, it's 80% mental and 20% physical. How on earth did you get involved in golf?
Well, I got through there was this chain of recommendations. I was doing this work in tennis, and one of my students happened to be the promotions manager for the company that used to sponsor me. He used to give me rackets, Head. So he used to take lessons. He was also responsible for the contracts of all the players that they sponsored, one of whom was our best player at the time, a fellow called Buster Mottram. So he thought what I was doing with him would help Buster, and he connected us. And as Buster and I explored this approach, Buster went from 90 to 19 in the world. So that's a pretty impressive leap up the rankings, very exciting for me to be involved in. And from the PR that went with that, I was approached by some golfers who played on the European tour, and they said, I think what you're doing might help us in our golf. And the truth is, I said no at first. I had no interest in the game. I'd never played. In those days, I didn't even think golf was a proper sport, to tell the truth. Because you don't see golfers run, do you?
No.
And the only reason I got involved was one of them was an Irishman. His name's, who's now quite a well-known broadcaster, David Fearty. And he broadcasts on CBS television now. He's an analyst, and he has this wonderful Irish sense of humor. So I said yes, because he was so much fun to hang out with. And he and another golfer, fellow Welshman, actually, David Llewellyn, won tournaments on the tour in applying these principles. And that's how it started for me in golf. One thing kept leading for another.
And it wasn't technique or physical technique. It's mental technique.
That's a good way to describe it. It was just like there's a physical technique to playing a sport. There's the biomechanics. There are some fundamentals to mental technique. They seem to be common to all athletes. And most of them are trainable skills to some degree. And that's what I ended up, that's the kind of career path. That's how I got sidetracked off the tennis court, if you like, into doing all these other things.
Okay, I'm going to put you under the spotlight. I'm going to play the part of the Spanish Inquisition. But, I'll just bet you've heard this question before. Self-help, and coaching books, they're 10 a penny. You don't walk into any bookstore. What makes you already know how to be great a different animal?
I think, first of all, let me say, I agree with you. I think they are 10 a penny. I'm a born somewhere between a skeptic and a cynic, being Welsh. And that's part of why it took so long to write this, because I think there is so much out there. I think what's different is that this it takes a different approach. It actually turns the approach to try to do things better upside down. That's what actually happened to me these years ago. So typically what happens when we try to learn how to be better and do better, we assume that we've got to accumulate a lot of knowledge, we have to find experts, we have to read books about it, and once we've got that magical piece of knowledge, that's going to enable us to break through. Now, if that was true, we'd all read whatever book it would be, or books, and then we'd all become world champions. And that obviously isn't true, because we're not all world champions, so there have to be some other factors involved. And those factors affect how we use what we already know. And this book is much more about dealing with those three other factors. I call them faith, fire, and focus. If you can develop faith, fire, and focus, and focus, by the way, is the one that really influences the others. If you develop skills in being focused, it changes our faith, our belief in ourselves. It changes our energy, our commitment, motivation. And it makes using the knowledge that we already have much, much easier. And that's so we remove that which blocks faith, fire, and focus. And that's what I'd call an inside-out approach. It lets out what's already inside us. So I guess I'm saying people don't really need to learn anything new. The breakthroughs much more often than not come from using what we already know in a much more effective way.
Okay, faith is a belief in the pathway you're taking. Focus is obviously deciding that pathway. Fire. What is fire?
Well, let me back it up a little bit. Faith is your belief that you can deal with whatever comes up. So it's your belief in yourself, your ability to deal with problems that come in front of you. And there's a lot of research about the people that do that are the ones that become top performers. The people that don't believe they can do that and avoid making errors don't become top performers. Fire is about your energy, your passion, your commitment to doing something, your desire to do it. It's like the fuel for focus, which is your ability to pay attention to the critical things. And they all influence each other. But focus is the one. Another way to talk about focus is it's all about what you pay attention to. That's what creates your beliefs. And once you have a belief, that directs what you pay attention to. And both of them will either, if they're pointed in the right direction, they'll raise your energy, your fire. And if they're pointed in the wrong direction, they'll tend to dampen your fire or make it negative.
What decided you to write the book? I know that, you know, that you've been involved in coaching for many, many years. Did you just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to write me a book?
No, I'd had many requests. Gosh, 15 years ago, the BBC asked me to do this. And writing isn't my favorite thing to do. It wasn't, it was a task I avoided. But over the years, I had so many requests from the people who would participate in our training programs. They wanted some way to remind themselves of what we were teaching them. They wanted some way to share it. And people used to see a lot of application beyond their corporate workplace. So because they're using this material, they would go away and they would use it with their kids and use it with their friends. So in the end, my colleagues really made me aware of how many requests we were getting, and it just seemed like a good thing to do.
Incidentally, I enjoyed the book a great deal. And on that note, let's do a shameless commercial. Where can people find copies of it?
They can find it in any of the major bookstores. They can find it on Amazon. It's just generally published. Now there's electronic versions, there's audio versions. Anywhere that sells books.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Inside Out. Can you tell us about the company? What is your corporate mission, shall we say?
It's to, my favorite way to describe what we do would be to go back to the origins of the word coaching, which come from the 15th century in Europe. And in those days, a coach was something that took valued people from where they are to where they want to go. And I think that's what we do as an organization. We take valued people or valued organizations from where they are to where they want to go. So we're an organization that helps people deal with performance issues or find ways to raise levels of performance.
Do you have a website? I mean, that's a silly question.
Isn't it? Yes, www.insideoutdev.com.
Obviously, you are absolutely no stranger to public speaking, and neither am I. But many people are. Is it a teachable skill? Can you reinvent someone?
I think it is, to a large degree, a trainable skill. I mean, it's a little bit like, can everybody win Wimbledon? No. Can everybody be better as a tennis player? Almost certainly. And I do speak from personal experience as someone who is so painfully shy that I've actually frozen in front of a class of tennis students, not being able to get a word out of my mouth. So I had to learn the skills of public speaking. And this very material, actually, is part of how I learned to do that. That's what makes me willing to kind of get out there and preach about it, is it's made such a difference in my life.
What kind of reader feedback are you getting from the book?
So far, it's been very positive. So I'm thrilled to say, but nobody's taken the trouble to write in and say, I didn't like it. But people have taken the trouble to write in and say, I loved it and I'm passing it on.
No, I have to admit that, you know, and I told you this earlier, I enjoyed the book. It was a little different from the normal, self-help coaching book, in that, you know, you approached it from not just a business perspective, but a personal perspective. And I like that a lot.
I know I've found in teaching over the years that showing people how they can use this beyond their work life is, particularly if they can use it with their kids in their families, it kind of gets them at some kind of intrinsic level. It'll grab their attention. And so, I mean, that was the route we took for producing the book, is just to tell quite literally what had been going on in the classroom and in people's lives. So there's nothing theoretical in there, in the sense that there's nothing theoretical, because it's an accumulation of what people have said and done over the years.
I'm going to go back to public speaking just for a second. Do you have any general tips? I mean, yeah, some recommend that if you're shy, you don't want to do it, the best way is to, unfocus the audience and maybe just pick on one or two people and talk to them as if you were having a conversation. Is that a good plan?
I think so. I think the airlines try to teach us the basic principle when they say, put your own oxygen mask on before you try and help anybody else put theirs on. because they're saying, you know, if you're unconscious, you can't be helpful to anybody else. So as a public speaker, if you're so full of what I would call interference, if your mind's so busy that you can't think straight, then the whole notion, for instance, of have eye contact with everybody in the audience is going to be terrifying. So the basic principle is if you control what you pay attention to, that has an effect on everything else that you do. So instead of looking, trying to have eye contact with everybody, find the one person in the group who, I call them head nodders. They're smiling, they're nodding. Whatever you say, they're going to nod their head at you. And talk to them until you feel comfortable. Once you feel comfortable, then you can start making eye contact with a few other people. A similar principle is maintain your posture, because when we get nervous, we tend to hunch our shoulders over. We tend to want to put our hands in our pockets. So, and we teach athletes this a lot. Maintain your posture, because if you're standing upright and you're focused on doing that, it slows the mind down, stops it racing. Same principle. Control. Always control what you pay attention to, because that triggers everything else.
I have to ask you this, and I touched on it earlier. In your book, you include many very personal stories. Is this the style that you use when talking to large companies?
Yes. I wouldn't know what else to do other than speak from experience. It would be hard for me to get up and talk about something that's just theory for me. If I'm going to ask other people to do something, and I'm basically asking them to trust me for a while, then I need to have kind of done it myself. Otherwise, I have no credibility with them. So, yeah, it's exactly what I would do.
Yeah, and I was amazed. And you have stories about, you know, your young children, your teenager, and they're not. But they're not stories that say, you know, Alan Fine is the best father in the world. It's, hey, these are my children.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just, there's stories in there that not just my experiences with my kids. Many people gave us stories to include in this of how they'd use this material with their kids. But my kids have been the subject of my experiments over the years, bless their hearts. So I think they've grown up and gone to college, you know, we could argue, in spite of what I did to them or because of what I did to them.
Right. Yes. I don't think we need to go any further down that pathway. Right. I have to say that I very much enjoy interviewing people. Often they are folks that I've never talked to before. And I have this kind of unwritten thing that goes through my brain. Yeah. And I have to answer it in the first couple of minutes. Is my guest a yes-no kind of a person? Or is he, she a talker? And then I move on to what I call the pain threshold. I don't want to make my guest uncomfortable. It's unproductive and time-wasting. I see you as a talker and a man with a pretty high pain threshold. Am I right?
I'm not sure what you mean by a high pain threshold. I'm not sure I should say yes to this, because it could be in preparation for yet another question.
Oh, no, I mean, you know, someone that doesn't mind fielding questions. Yeah, maybe not the best questions. But
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. I mean, you can't be involved in teaching and coaching as long as I have without being willing to be honest about what you know, and particularly about what you don't know.
Right.
So,
okay.
You know, what's the worst that can happen with a question is I don't know the answer.
Okay. So here's the question. What's the worst thing that stands out in your mind? You know, something that only a road warrior like you and I could endure.
The worst thing a road warrior could endure.
Well, road warriors like you and I.
I think it's the airlines. I think it's. I mean, it's. I guess it's just going on this week. It's more security that seems to be applied randomly and doesn't make me feel any more secure as a road warrior.
Right. And I'm guessing you do spend a great deal of time away from home.
Yes, I do. I do. And the airlines are grateful for that.
Well, I'm sure. I spent 3 decades in corporate America, and I got to admit, I was so glad to escape at the end. I like the term corporate stupidity. Some companies acquire a mindset that only a mother could love. I'm sure that you've encountered a few. How do you deal with it?
Well, I'm a problem solver. You know, I started coaching when I was, 12 years old, because the tennis coach at the tennis club I joined after I reached that final said, if we're going to let you play with the adults because you show a little promise, you're going to help me with the younger kids. And that's how I started coaching. And always what I'm looking for is how can we just help people do things better? So, you know, on the one hand, when I see organizations that kind of are stuck in particular cultures or mindsets, to me that's an opportunity, isn't it?
And I suppose.
That's what a coach lives for. You know, if everybody's playing out of their mind, what do I get to do?
I like that, and it is a term I have personally used. You know, oh, it's not a problem, it's an opportunity. But, you know,
I'll tell you something else that really drives home to me, though, is if you watch one-year-old children, you notice how they have this incredible passion for everything. They're into everything. And when I look at an organization, I try to see beyond the people and go back to when they were 1 year old, these folks, you know, were just thirsty to learn. They were into everything. And all I'm looking at now is the way they've tried to organize their lives to protect themselves from the painful experiences. That's what shuts down learning. So if I retain that mindset when I go in an organization, that makes it an awful lot easier. These folks don't want to feel like the way they do, because on the weekend they're getting up at 5 a.m. to go fishing or take their kid. You know, they do it with a huge amount of fire. So something shuts them down. My job is to help try and remove what shuts them down.
And as I understand it, you have worked with a large number of well-known corporations.
Yes. Over the years, yes.
Yeah. I think in the book, IBM, Honeywell, help me.
Procter & Gamble, NASA, Sun Microsystems, Yum Brands, Carlson Companies.
Do you plan on putting out another book?
Well, I didn't plan on this one, so really whatever I said I'm not sure I would trust whatever I said to this. I have had several inquiries to do applications of the material in this book. And a couple of them are quite interesting to me.
Yeah, I could see, taking the book and not so much ripping it apart, but turning it into a series of miniature projects. I think that might work very well. You know, a series of workbooks, if you will.
Mm-hmm. If for me to do this, I always have to be persuaded that it's going to be something that people will have value for, and as opposed to just doing it as a marketing exercise. And maybe that's why it took so long to get me to do this one, because until I was convinced that this was something that people were going to make use with, then I didn't have a lot of interest in it. So if these inquiries, as we explore it, if I'm convinced that this is something that people will have value for, then I'd be quite happy to do that.
Okay. I'm being whined at in my ear by the infamous automated producer that our time is just about up. So I do want to thank you very, very much for taking time out to talk with me today, and I want to wish you every success with You Already Know How to Be Great.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Okay, and I do hope that we can talk again in the future.
I'd love that.
Okay, Alan, you have a great day. And
thanks.
As I said, hopefully we will talk again. Till next time, goodbye.